Environment and Natural Resources will come to order. Apologize for my delay. And thank you for the members in the audience's patience. The first bill on the agenda is Senate File 2480. Senator Olsen. Are we not taking him first?
Yes. Yes, he's been here.
Okay. Do the why don't the witnesses start approaching the table? Randy Anhorn, Jackie Anderson. Start the are there
opponents to the bill here?
Proponents of the bill can come forward and we can start the testimony.
Senator Olsen.
I'm sure he'll be here shortly and we can certainly start with your testimony.
With me today is
Senator, would you like to begin?
Senator Vandeveer and members, I have a hard time getting used to being in two places at one time. So I know you guys, veterans, are pretty used to that. Today we're here on the Comfort Lake and Forest Lake Watershed District. And a portion of this is in Chisago County, approximately 20%. And approximately the remaining 80% is in Washington County. And we're here to have a bill to give it well, I'll let Randy address this.
Okay.
He's Randy Anhorn, who is the
I don't know why.
Southern Chisago County, as Senator Olsen had mentioned. We currently work under Minnesota Statute 103D, which is a statute governing watershed districts throughout the state. In the early 80s, because of rapid urbanization, new statute 103B was enacted for metro watershed districts. Because Comfort Lake, Forest Lake is not wholly located within the seven-county metropolitan area, it was still considered 103D. We are here today to try to get designated or start the process of getting designated 103B, which provides a more efficient process to implement projects that are stated in your watershed management plan and your capital improvement plan to address impairments of water quality in the watershed district, of which Comfort Lake, Forest Lake has six lakes currently listed as impaired by the Pollution Control Agency. I guess for the short of it, that's the bill and why we're here in front of you today.
It's split between two counties. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Watershed
actually, it's about 60% in Washington County, 40% in Chisago County.
Okay, very good. Further witnesses, testimony?
No, I think Randy covered it pretty well.
Was there Susan Young?
Susan Young was supposed to, Mr. Chair, Susan Young was supposed to show up today. She is not here. She was the city council person for the city of Forest Lake. And also we had down Jackie Anderson, our president, who had prior commitment.
All right. Questions for Senator Olsen or the witnesses?
I might.
Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I might just have a question for council on what they're asking. I mean, is this typical?
Well,
am I understanding even what they're asking for? I guess I'm not sure.
Yeah. Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scogin, the issue really is metro counties or metro watershed planning is done under different sections of law than outside of the metro. So the seven counties within the metropolitan area have a different way and a different form of doing their water planning. Outside of it, they use the Greater Minnesota or county planning process. And what they want to do is, since they're not wholly within the metropolitan area, they otherwise would be under the planning provisions outside of the metropolitan area. And they want to be in the planning provisions that are within the metropolitan area, because I guess apparently there are certain provisions in the metropolitan plan that they feel that would work better for them. And I guess the only other issue would be whether or not there are any greater ability to raise money under the in the metropolitan area one or the out as opposed to the outstate or outside of the metropolitan area.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Then, Mr. Anhorn, then 60% of the district is metro or out of metro.
Anhorn,
Mr. Chair and Senator, 60% of the area of the district is within the seven county metro area in Washington County.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. I also have Mr. John Lynch, who is a manager in the watershed district.
Yeah, we introduced ourselves.
Anyone want to testify in opposition to the bill? Senator Vandeveer. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Ray Vandeveer, Forest Lake. At this point, I would be in opposition to the bill. We've discussed it and with the administrator, and the one issue is that while 60% of the land affected is in the metro, 85% of the tax base for the watershed would be in the metro area and would be in the district that I represent. And we had been discussing some proposals to have some review of the levy of the watershed district, because at present what we'd be doing is giving them unlimited taxing authority, property tax authority in the district at a time when property taxes have been rising dramatically. So we had had some proposals that we had been discussing, because we do want to assist the watershed in becoming more effective, hopefully. That's not the issue. It's just simply that there would be little preview over the budget of the district. So we had proposed that the Washington County Board review and the Chisago County Board review their levy. They didn't think that was acceptable. So at this point, they are functioning as most of the watersheds do in the state, and so I would oppose this going forward until we reach some resolution on our small areas of disagreement.
Well, it depends on how you define moving forward. This needs to go to the tax committee, and I think the issue that you bring up is probably most relevant for that committee. And if you are working on compromises or different language, that would be a good forum for it.
Whatever you say, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, if I could, I'd like to also mention we actually do go through the review process with our counties. The county commissioners who appoint each and every one of our managers, we meet with them annually to present our budget. Our budgets are not approved by the county commissioners, however, but they are involved in the review process. And we do go through public hearings. Also, in the same kind of level there, I did go to each and every one of our local communities and received a letter of support, a resolution of support for our seeking 103B, which would include Scandia and Forest Lake and Wyoming Township, and Chisago City, as well as the local soil and water conservation districts as well.
Very good. Any other discussion? Well, Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Vandeveer, I wasn't listening quite closely enough as you went through the statistics that you gave us. You referenced 80 or 85%. Would you just do that?
Senator Vandeveer. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Senator Frederickson. Yes, the 60% of the landmass we're discussing, or the watershed district, is in the metro area, which would be in the district I represent, and 85% of the tax base that would be funding the activity of the watershed is in the district that I represent.
And that's Washington County?
Yes.
Senator Scogin.
I move Senate File 2480 be recommended to pass and make its next stop at the Tax Committee.
Senator Scogin moves that Senate File 2480 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. Further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you,
Senator. Mr. Chair and members, thank you.
Next item on the agenda is Senate File 2517, Senator Rest.
Chairman and members, Senate File 2517 addresses an area that I have been working in for a number of years now, and it has to do with the discharge of ballast water in our Great Lakes systems, and in particular, of course, we're concerned in Minnesota with the discharge of ballast water that has wreaked such havoc with the introduction of nuisance aquatic invasive species to our Great Lakes system. And this bill reflects a lot of the work that's been done by Congressman Oberstar in the federal bill that he has introduced. And we have taken a number of the provisions, and I work on this with Representative Hansen in the House, a number of the provisions in the federal bill and suited them to operation in the state. In addition, I think it's important that although all of us would like for the federal government, and I'll say this over and over again, all of us would like for the federal government to act responsibly and to protect the Great Lakes, which are 20% of the fresh water, surface fresh water in the entire world, and it's something like, I think it's like 85% of the fresh water in the United States. So it is a critical asset for us. It is a critical asset for us with regard to our economic vitality. Duluth is certainly the jewel, in my opinion, not only of Minnesota. It's my favorite city, but it is also the jewel port of the whole Great Lakes system. And I don't know if any of you have ever been up there and watched those great boats. I guess not boats. I guess they're ships, but come into or leave the Duluth Harbor. You know how majestic they are and how they cannot fail to impress upon us the importance of shipping to our state and to the whole system of the Great Lakes. But there's also an environmental concern about affecting other areas of our economy and tourism and so forth beyond that of just the shipping. So this bill proceeds to offer a regulatory model for the control and regulation of the discharge of ballast water in Lake Superior in the jurisdiction that we would have as the state of Minnesota, again, based on the federal model, though obviously not totally so, because the federal bill that Congressman Oberstar has preempts any action by the states. So we certainly didn't include that. But just as in renewable energy standards and in predatory lending, the states, and in particular Minnesota, have been leaders and models for action by the federal government. We believe that this is also an appropriate area for Minnesota to become a leader in. There was a communication from the Pollution Control Agency, in this bill, they would assume the major responsibility for this regulatory system, dated February 15th, which I believe you may have, as well as a handout from them, which I hope you also have. If not, I'm sure they will provide it to you, of comments from the MPCA and the DNR about the bill. The one of the author's amendments that I have for you is an attempt to respond to some of their concerns. Otherwise, we need to have some ongoing discussions about other parts of the bill with them. And according to their handout, they seem to be very willing to continue those discussions. I would, for anyone on the committee besides myself who is interested in it, the PCA is having two stakeholder meetings this coming week, one of them on March 3rd from 2 to 4 p.m. in the boardroom of the PCA in St. Paul, or on Tuesday, March 4th, probably not one that's available to most of us, 10 a.m. to noon in the large conference room in Duluth. The another major issue that has come to the fore in with regard to ballast water, that is a critical issue, I mean really critical issue for Minnesota, is the VHS virus. And we have a map among the your papers that show you the how the viral hemorrhagic septicemia, and it is shortened to VHS and has nothing to do with video recording, how it has spread in the Great Lakes region from 2003 to 2007. And we see it moving, taking over in some of the lakes in terms of where it is seen, but then also we see no dots yet in Lake Superior. So acting on controlling ballast water, which has really not happened for 30 years, needs to start happening, and it needs to start happening now. With that introduction, I'd like to go over the bill for you, but Mr. Chairman, I wonder if we could adopt the author's amendment.
Pass that out.
This is an author's amendment, so we won't debate this, but while it's being passed out, Senator Ress, maybe you could just summarize what
Yes, I certainly will. The A1 amendment, if that's the one that's coming, is an initial response to some of the concerns raised by the PCA. And first of all, it clarifies in the ballast water uptake and discharge requirements that indeed you can't dump water without a permit, and they had raised that issue that it needed to be clarified, and we did that there. Page 11, they were concerned in subdivision 2, they were concerned about the issue of the design requirements, and at their suggestion deleted that requirement, and that had to do with sediment management, which I'll mention later on. And then in added a comment, 17. To the rapid response plan, that we understand that we do some things to the extent that are on page 15, going back. In section 10, raised a concern about the subdivision regarding detention, their authority to detain vehicle vessels, and we also deleted that subdivision. To March 25th, which with regard to dealing with VHS, the department has, we changed the date to reflect the date that they believe that the Sioux locks are going to be open, which is not April 15th, but they have made an estimate that it's going to be March 25th. So we included that, that we moved that date to correspond to what they were that they were indicating, and then we just added some clarifying language into that paragraph. So that's what the A1 amendment is, Mr. Chairman.
This is an author's amendment that will get it in the shape she desires on the A1. Senator Olson moves the A1. Thank you. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's
Mr.
adopted.
Chairman, there
Senator
was
Rest.
There was a second amendment that was a more technical one.
Pass that out.
You have that one, too?
Yep.
It's a clarifying one that it talking at some instances that we're talking about the Commissioner Pollution Control Agency and important and reflects also another concern raised by them, and that is this bill, the language of this bill is being put in the statute, even though the duties are being given to the PCA, it's being put into the statute of the DNR, which has there's a complementary relationship between the control of invasive species. The bill puts the actionable regulation with the PCA. The PCA questions whether it shouldn't be put in their own statute. We didn't change that here, but I do think that that is a valid point that they raised. So the this is actually a fairly a technical amendment that changes those words at various points.
Senator Olson, would you like to move the A2 as well?
Sure.
So moved. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Senator Rest.
Thank you, then. The bill, as amended, Senate Bill 2517, does indeed establish state regulation of balanced water discharged into Lake Superior by establishing ballast water exchange discharge treatment standards and requiring a permit. And the again, the requirements are based on requirements that are being proposed at the federal level by Congressman Oberstar. So in the first section, there are just a number of definitions that are then used throughout the bill. Section 2 addresses phasing in the ballast water requirements with standards that would need to be met over a phased-in time period and what standards would need to be met, reasonable standards need to be met and required at every point, allowing the commissioner to charge reasonable fees to recover the cost of the program. And those vessels that would be exempt from it, including, of course, U.S. Armed Forces and those vessels that have sealed tanks, which would not be subject to the permitting. Section 3 does indeed deal with ballast water uptake and discharge, and that was part of the author's amendment to make sure that we're talking that you can't do it unless you have a permit. The ballast water exchange requirements.
Excuse me, Senator Rest, there was a question on that. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, I'm not well informed about the construction of these vessels, but now you talked about a vessel having sealed tanks and some having, you know, allowing being they're authorized to have ballast water, but don't. I thought that there was, they take on ballast water when they are traveling without a load,
mm-hmm.
And then they discharge it when they load in. Well, how does the sealed ballast tanks work?
They're rest.
They just have water in them and they don't.
And they must need to carry that at every point. I guess I can't answer that particular question based on any technical knowledge I have, but that is what the federal bill is requiring too. But I think it is clear that we do not want to inhibit the action of the Coast Guard, for example, or military vessels. We don't want to require them to make permits because they just operate under a set of different rules and regulations.
So,
Senator Olson,
Mr. Chair,
this would be for ocean-going vessels and
Lakers. They are not taking on ballast water in contaminated areas that
we
would
have
to worry.
What if they have a sealed tank? So you wouldn't. If they had a sealed tank for whatever reason,
yeah.
So they're not taking on and they're not discharging, those particular boats, ships would not come under these regulations
and
for obvious reasons.
And Mr. Chairman, that tends to be the Coast Guard and some of those that aren't.
No, I was saying that's the second exemption. First one would be sealed tanks, and the second one would be U.S. military vessels.
So there are commercial vessels that use sealed tanks. That don't discharge, and we're not interested in regulating those that will never discharge the water anyway.
That's correct.
Okay.
Take on one.
Okay.
The ballast water exchange requirements, I would welcome discussion there with the PCA on Section 4. The federal bill only deals with ocean-going vessels, and this particular bill would also have a requirement for Lakers, that is, those ships that operate only on the Great Lakes system itself and do not go into open water and the ocean. So paragraph A, in terms of the requirement, would require vessels subject to the permit requirements and who are exempted from ballast water treatment requirements established in Section 5, which is the next section, to conduct ballast water exchanges according to rules that are set up by the commissioner using appropriate technology and management treatment technology. Paragraph B defines the technology that is at least as effective technology that in tests done prior to installation of a system removes or kills at least 98% of the organism larger than 50 microns, and that is a standard that, at least from the scientific investigations, to my knowledge, is an indicator of control of ballast water.
So, what would we be talking about? A chlorination system, or
the commissioner can indicate throughout the permitting system regulations what kinds of systems would meet the requirements.
Is there
and
a typical one that's
all throughout,
used?
All throughout the bill, there's rulemaking authority given to the commissioner to set rules that would meet the standards.
I was just wondering if there's a typical one that is often used.
When we hear from the advocates for the bill, that who are far more scientifically inclined than I am, that question might be more appropriate for them, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
Then paragraph C, under Section 4, requires the commissioner to establish guidelines by January 1st on sound water.
Mr. Chairman, treatment. Senator S., could you move that mic a little closer to you? I appreciate it. Thank you.
I'm trying to do better. Is that better?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. In Section 5.
Mr. Chair.
question, Senator Saxog.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, on Section 4, Subdivision 2, requiring operators to conduct ballast water exchange at least 200 miles from the nearest point of land at a depth of at least 200 meters. Where are we talking about in the Great Lakes?
We're talking about ocean-going vessels discharging in the ocean and not in the Great Lakes.
In the Great Lakes. So this couldn't be this
for ocean-going vessels.
This isn't going to be in the Great Lakes, then.
Correct. That exchange, they have to, and part of when we get to the rest of the bill, we'll see where they have to maintain records on board that are accessible to the commissioner. They have to be in English. They have to be available for examination. They have to keep a record of where they did an exchange, including whether they, if they did it in open water, which would be in the ocean. Which we hope that's where they're doing it right now anyway.
Right. So, Mr. Chair, so this has not, I mean, there'll be no ballast exchange on the Great Lakes.
Now we're talking to Ellen Ocean.
Only under a permit. Yeah, there needs to be ballast water exchange, but for ocean-going vessels, we want it done initially in the ocean. Whatever happens to has to be done inside the Great Lakes, we want under this regulatory system where the ballast water is treated. So that's what the 200 miles refers to.
For ocean-going vessels, we want them the ballast water to be exchanged way away from our country.
Right, and for the.
It,
when it's done inside the Great Lakes, we don't want it done closer than 50 nautical miles, if you read the rest of that, from the nearest point of land and in waters that are at least 200 meters in depth. And so it's fine with me if they do it in Lake Huron, where we already have VHS, as a matter of fact. And I don't mean that, I don't mean to be flippant with that, but we're very concerned about the invasion of VHS in Lake Superior. And because some of the time, just generally, the invasive species are present for years before they're discovered, we don't know that we don't already have VHS in Lake Superior, and it's just waiting to rear its ugly head any day now. So in Section 5, the ballast water is the section that deals with the ballast water treatment requirements. I won't go into each of the subdivisions there, but we can certainly get back to them if you like. I would like to get to the testimony, Mr. Chairman, and I do know that there are folks that have concerns about this bill as well, and that we're also due in session at 2:30, so I'm trying to be mindful of our time constraints. In Section 6 deals with sediment management. That is the stuff that's left over, and we're going to remove that and dispose of it. In response to the PCA's concern, we deleted the design requirements subdivision 2. And once again, the commissioner would be granted rulemaking authority to adopt rules that would govern facilities for the reception of the sediment when it is removed from the ballast tanks. Section 7 requires operators of vessels that are required to get a permit, remembering that there are some that are exempt, to operate their vessel according to an approved ballast water management plan. Section 8 requires a ballast water record book. Section 9 allows the commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency to examine vessels before issuing permits, to determine that Dig Number 1 had an approved ballast water management plan, a record book, and that the equipment that is used both for ballast water treatment and sediment management is installed and working properly and allows for the commissioner to have subsequent inspections. Subdivision 7 originally given authority to the commissioner to detain vessels if that vessel was required to have a permit and wasn't in compliance. They considered that impractical and not feasible, and we removed that section, that subdivision, from the bill. Section 10 deals with consultation and cooperation among the Great Lakes, and there are any number of organizations that are stakeholder organizations for the operations of the Great Lakes. There's the Great Lakes Governors Association, which our governor was a very fine leader with regard to the Great Lakes Compact, which Minnesota was the first state to ratify last year, quickly followed by Illinois, and perhaps next state to do it will be New York, but which has run into some issues in states that do not have the fine water permitting system that Minnesota had in place for decades. One of those is a Great Lakes panel on aquatic nuisance species. Currently, the DNR is the member, and as the PCA notes point out, they are in the process of asking for the PCA to be their alternate. In the bill, we have the PCA being the member. Currently, Minnesota Sea Grant is the alternate. Be also an issue that I'd be very happy to talk with the PCA about. Of course, the Great Lakes are part of our border system, and so we also need cooperation with Canada, in particularly Ontario and Quebec. Section 11 calls on the PCA to develop a rapid response plan with regard to invasive species. The PCA, particularly with regard to setting up a state center, brings up some concerns about the costs of implementing a rapid response plan. Section 12 deals specifically with VHS, and asked him to develop an emergency plan to, we hope, prevent the introduction rather than slow down the spread, because we don't know in any of these invasive species whether they are just lurking beyond the surface of our waters and that we'll discover them any day. And then Section 13 requires speaks to the ballast water management reports and the requirement for that. And so that is the bill setting up this system. Once again, we all would like the federal government to take this action and to do it now, but we know that just as the case in other areas, the federal government has been slow to act, and so the states have taken it on themselves, again, with the renewable energy, with predatory lending, and we believe that it's appropriate for us to take the lead in controlling ballast water discharge and exchange on the Great Lakes, and in particular our own Lake Superior. So, Mr. Chairman, if I could, I'd like to invite the testifiers in support of the bill to come forward.
Very well. Mr. Van Offlin.
Mm-hmm. Chairman, I'm going to move there so I can see.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for hearing me today. As soon as this fires up, I will go through some a presentation I put together that you have in front of you. For the record, my name is Henry Van Offlin. I work for Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. I am their natural resource scientist. My background is that I have a bachelor's degree in fisheries from University of Minnesota and a master's degree in fisheries from Cornell University. I became familiar with ballast water issues in graduate school. My academic advisor, my major professor, was the Great Lakes Fishery Commission chairman 20 years ago. We were talking about these issues, and I haven't paid attention to them a lot since then, but they are still with us, and I'm going to present some facts on things urge you to take some action in support of this bill. So this will take a few minutes. I will try and go through this as quickly as possible. This is a complicated issue. It'll probably be about 15 minutes. I'll try and go. And I appreciate your time. USDA APHIS, which is their plant and animal and health inspection service, issued an emergency order in 2007 or 2006, I can't remember at the moment, that VHS is an extremely serious pathogen of fresh and saltwater fish. Unlike many diseases, 28 species of fish are affected under natural conditions. They just updated their list back in November. There are some of the species, very common species in Minnesota and throughout the Great Lakes. And many diseases that we have in fish don't affect a broad range of species. They're very selective. Some of them are, some of them aren't. VHS is one that's very broad in its influence. The way it affects fish is it's causing internal and external hemorrhaging. This is a cutaway of a fish bleeding internally. Another one, that's both internal and external. The skin is flipped over there. You can see it's been bleeding on the wall of the belly. And then it also can cause, and this is in a walleye, bulging eyes, and there is also bleeding on the skin in this fish. This in my posters, Allison. So it affects fish. There's some of the press reports have been out there is that it's the Ebola of fish diseases. So unlike many diseases, it's also most lethal at cold temperatures, thus the concern about Lake Superior, very cold water lake, and VHS is most active at cold temperatures. The virus is spread easily from fish to fish through contact with bodily fluids. If a round goby, which we have in Lake Superior, were to be transported here, had VHS, another fish ate it, it's possible that that fish would then contract VHS. It could be spread through during spawning time and through contact with fish urine even. Once established, we expect the disease would persist in fish populations and there would be periodic acute disease outbreaks. And according to the Fish and Wildlife Service, this is the strain of the virus. There's one strain that's hit the Great Lakes, and it's a new introduction that has probably had assistance, such as ballast water. Again, such as ballast water, I am not saying that ballast water in any way is the only possible vector or pathway for this disease to move around the Great Lakes. And this is the progression of the disease, and I think, we're talking about it here today because it has not yet reached Lake Superior that we know of. And now is the time to act. The epicenter for this and for most of the diseases that are, and invasive species that are coming in the Great Lakes is in the Detroit region. And that it was observed there first in 2003. It was also present in 2005, 2006. The red dots, the orange dots are 2004, 2005. The red dots are 2006, and the black dots are 2007. So it occurred in Lake Erie. There was large outbreaks of death, fish kills in freshwater drum, muskie, and some yellow perch. And it then has progressed and was in Lake Huron, those two up at the top of the mitt there of Michigan, two at in 2006. And I want you to note those two because later I have another slide where we show where most of the ballast water is being dumped in the lake. The black dots, it's moved into Wisconsin in 2007 and has moved inland. Just a sort of review of the value and the investment that we put in Lake Superior as in Minnesota. Approximately 4.5% of the statewide fisheries budget, 22% of the cold water budget is allocated to the Lake Superior program, and estimate that about $1.4 million a year has been spent. This is from DNR's Lake Superior Management Plan. Sea Grant produced something. This is older data, but it's the most current one that I could find. $9.74 million in direct expenditures to the state in 1990. When they use the multipliers, which those economists seem to do, we're at the $12 to $17.5 million for the value of that fishery. If we just do some very quick and dirty, what could happen to the fishery if 1% or 10% of the fish in any given year there was an outbreak? We could be in the range, and this is very simple, basic analysis. This is not a complicated economic analysis of, you know, somewhere in the $200 to $2 million range. That doesn't count what it would do to tourism. That's simply if we had this many dead fish, what the amount those fish are valued at, just like if it were a fish kill. And kind of that's VHS 101. I wanted to talk a little bit about ballast water as a vector also. Ballast water from ships is the primary source of non-indigenous invasive species in the Great Lakes. It's responsible for about 65% of those invasives that have gotten into the Great Lakes since 1959. In Lake Superior, we have about 32 non-native species. This is probably a couple more since this data was produced. 17 of them are fish. And the fish that we know of and that were unintentionally introduced to Lake Superior, 9 of them here, the top 6 are most likely to have been introduced by ballast water. Many of these are on the list of carrying VHS. A little bit of terms, and we've already, I think you guys, it sounds like you already have some familiarity with this. As I go through a few more slides here, they're sort of salties and Lakers, and then you'll see these terms, Bob and no Bob. Those are related to the salties. Bob is ballast on board. The no Bobs are no ballast on board. And this is important because many of the regulations that have been in effect up till now do not affect no Bobs or Lakers. And they are the majority of the ships that come in to Lake Superior. Many of the ships come in to the Eastern Great Lakes, unload their cargo, take ballast water in, say at Detroit. They come in without ballast water, thus they're not. Most of them are not covered under any of the existing laws for ballast water exchange, ballast water management. Although things have been improving. Again, back to the map. Just keep moving. Oh, there was just a report published or some information published recently on 2005. These are the top ports that contribute ballast water to the rest of the Great Lakes. Okay. Detroit, Nanticoke, Ontario, Gary, Indiana, St. Clair, Michigan is right near Detroit. Cleveland, Ohio are some of the big ones. So they may unload in Detroit, take on ballast water. That's why Detroit is a donor to the rest of the Great Lakes. Those are the top 8. So one of these
521 indicates what?
Number of times that they take in ballast.
Okay.
So as these authors says, if an AIS gets introduced to one of these ports by any vector, it will likely spread to other locations. These ports are important in prevention. Here's just a map of that, where a lot of the ballast water sources are, most of them in the Eastern Great Lakes. And then these are the top receivers, and we're number one. Superior Duluth is number one. Two Harbors is number two. Calcite, Michigan, I want to note that one, is number three. And then Stoneport, Michigan is number six. And that was 2005. And that, according to this, the Superior Duluth gets about a little over 5 billion gallons of ballast water. And the map didn't show. I'm going to pass out another set of these maps.
We do have it.
Yeah, this map has got a couple additional things on it. If I could pass this out. I see you're at PowerPoint 2002 here, and we need to maybe upgrade because I'm just going to make a suggestion. So I'll go back to this map, which does work.
We're all tightening our belts, Mr. Spencer.
Yes. Okay. Good. I'm glad. I just want to note Swan River and Thunder Bay, where VHS showed up in 2006. Remember on that table I said Calcite and Stoneport, Michigan? Both those harbors, those ports, are right between those two red dots on the map. So the number three and number six donors just happened to be right near where we saw VHS the next year. So that's sort of some of the ballast water issues. Regulatory inaction. We've done a lot of voluntary things and had voluntary best management practices, both the U.S. and, which is under the Coast Guard, and the International Maritime Organizations. Beginning in 1993, there were mandatory ballast water exchange for ocean-going vessels only, the SALTIs. 30-plus years of meetings, reports, policy statements, and monitoring. If folks are interested, I have many websites to look at with tons of conference proceedings on ballast water and aquatic invasive species. Lots of science has been done. There's also been testing of ballast water treatment systems. Formally, some policy, the National Invasive Species Act, that gives Coast Guard authority over SALTIs and some NOBOBs, and there is a little bit of regulation on lake vessels. Someone else will have to get into this real detailed policy stuff if you would like that information. In 2001, there was this Great Lakes panel recommended elimination of aquatic nuisance species through Great Lakes system through best ballast water management practices. Ballast management technology is being developed. There's a new initiative in the Great Lakes on Lake Superior that's going to begin testing technology. And there's lots of technology. Again, go through the conference proceedings. Lots of technology out there that's been tried, tested. It never seems to get to the implementation phase. So that's what the Great Ships Initiative is doing up in Superior. They're going to test, bench test, and on-site test. They've duplicated ballast water tank conditions to test treatment. This one is from a presentation back in 2004 by Dr. Ed Mills, who works in upstate New York. He noted that enactment of ballast water guidelines, lots of these are guidelines and management practices, we have not seen a large number of or a reduction in the rate of invasion, as far as we can tell, which is, again, these are voluntary many times, and they apply to the SALTIs primarily. And just this last year, there was a publication, and I just quoted part of their conclusion, despite policy requiring mid-ocean exchange of ballast water, non-indigenous species continue to be introduced. And they estimated the size of the potential invasion just in the 2000 to 2002 was at least 17 unique taxa. That doesn't mean those 17 got introduced and were successful, but the potential is there and was there. Current proposed actions, DNR has got a legislative fact sheet that has a fish health initiative designed to prevent introduction of disease. It has a bunch of elements and three key measures. I view the DNR's approach at this point is if it gets into Lake Superior, then they have ways that they're going to try and deal with its movement from Lake Superior to other lakes or from, say, one of the larger lakes into smaller lakes. But I can't speak for them. That's just what I read in their legislative fact sheet. And then MPCA has suggested that they will be doing MPDES permitting with regulations to follow. We're very interested in what the details of that are. I think this bill and their comment sheet are starting to perhaps merge together in some ideas. As of last April, when we met with PCA over this issue, they did not seem all that interested in doing a permitting system at that time. Isle Royal, you may have heard, they have prohibited ballast water discharge without treatment in any waters near the park. That was just last September. And they are worried that it could cause catastrophic loss of recreational fishing opportunities at the park. They continue to be very active on VHS prevention. And they use either bleach, they do use bleach, and I'll explain that in a minute, but they've also in their order authorized several other treatments, which they believe would be effective in treating VHS. What they do is they mix 3 milligrams per liter of chlorine bleach into their ballast tanks for 200 minutes. They then neutralize that with vitamin C, and they have an NPDES permit from Michigan to do that. Just for reference, 3 milligrams per liter is not a terrible amount of chlorine. It is enough to kill VHS. The drinking water supplies typically have 1 milligram per liter.
But you say that gets neutralized with the sorbic acid?
Mr. Chair, yes. Yep. That's the approach that they have taken. They have been testing that, and it has worked so far. They're trying to improve their methods. If we took the Duluth port as an example, we assume 3 milligrams per liter and the vitamin C solution, it would cost approximately $522,000 a year to treat 3.8 billion gallons. If we assume that we actually are getting about double that ballast water into the Lake Superior, it would cost about $1 million. And last year there were 1,300 ships that came into Duluth, and only about 11% of those were salties. The rest were Lakers.
Do you know how many gallons last year?
No, and it's not. Those are not easy records to get a hold of. I would welcome anyone from the shipping industry to answer that question. I'm not.
Okay.
Perhaps the Pollution Control Agency has an answer. That was the data I had was from 2005. There are other ports that require treatment. In Chile, if you don't do deep water exchange, you have to bleach for 24 hours. In Argentina, if you come from areas where there's cholera, you have to chlorinate your ballast water. Most of these are all ocean ports also. All right, we continue to hear about the federal legislation. We heard about it in the House on Monday. I want to clarify some things. The federal legislation is for salties only, only 10% of the vessels that are operating in Lake Superior. It outlines ballast water exchange until treatment technology is available. Ballast water exchange is required until 2013 or 2015, depending on which bill it is. And there's discharge standards, which are the International Maritime Organization, which is what is in this bill. It allows for multiple 2 years delays. There's some loopholes in the federal law that allows ships to apply for, I need a two-year extension, with unlimited numbers of those. States are preempted from doing any regulation. In the Senate version, the Clean Water Act is preempted. And then only in the Senate version is there provisions in it that you can challenge within 120 days the rulemaking process at the federal level. So the federal bill is not going to solve the ballast water discharge issues that we have in Lake Superior. In conclusion, just VHS is a threat. We are fortunate it's not here yet. We do get the most ballast water. I view it as we have dodged the bullet. How long are we going to play Russian roulette with this disease? We can take action to reduce the risks. The Park Service has. I believe there's other things we can do to reduce the risk. Most of the past efforts have been voluntary. We've watched as the invasions continue. Federal regulations are not adequate, and honestly, we don't know if those will ever get passed. On another one, the International Maritime Organization has ballast water convention from 2004. The U.S. has not signed on to that yet. Once established, invasives are here forever and could have large and are having large economic impacts. It's been 30 years. We need leadership and action, just as we've done with the Great Lakes Compact. I think we can be leaders now with this bill. So,
questions for Mr. Ben Offlin. Senator Olson, did you have
some? Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ben Offlin, you know, for the decades that the invasives entering into the Great Lakes has been an issue, can you give any insights other than the total ineptitude of the federal government as to why there has not been any action taken until now? I mean, this is just fiddling while Rome burns. We continue down that path. Even what you've described as being proposed now seems like nothing. What's going on? Are there is there some interest that are this is really, really such an egregious process to try to prevent that these invasive species from coming? And I'm not talking just about the VHS. We've watched the march of invasive species in here, and we just kind of monitor it and then cope with it. Is there no sense that this is monetarily damaging, or do they feel that it is more damaging to, in fact, regulate or try to prevent it?
Mr. Van Offlin.
What's going on out there? Can you help me at all?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, first I'll talk a little bit about invasives and the ballast water and shipping issue. It is a complicated issue. I mean, this is a worldwide problem. If you go to IMO, there's all kinds of great conference proceedings on it is definitely a worldwide problem. And ballast water is one of the largest ways that invasive species are introduced throughout the world. The shipping industry is complicated. I mean, I'm not pretending at all that it isn't, that we have different countries involved, that sort of thing. I don't think that there is a will to really regulate ballast water within the industry myself. And I think the track record is fairly clear on that from my perspective. The other invasive issues...
Mr. Chairman, because they are not... The shipping industry, per se, is not affected by the negative impact of the introduction of invasive species. Other aspects of the economy would be, but that apparently isn't. So, therefore, who cares? Well, then, so then why, if the federal government, or our government, for that matter, sees the negative impact of it, why is the federal government willing to roll over for one segment and not attempt to deal with a protection of a possibly even larger, or maybe it isn't larger. Maybe it's something we should just live with and take the negative aspects so that life can roll on?
Mr. Van Offlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Olson. You know, I think a great example that you talk about is zebra mussels. That's costing electric power plants and water supply plants for millions of people that live around the Great Lakes millions of dollars a year, and that's being, paid by the citizens that rely on those systems. So, I can't answer all the questions about invasive species and the reasons that we have them. They are here, and we need to continue to take action to prevent them. Well, prevention is always the best measure.
Mr. Chairman, I guess you're not getting the point of my question. I know they're here, and I know we should take action, but I'm curious as to why at the federal government, with all we do know, why there has been no action or meaningful action. Do you have any clue as to what the forces are that prevent any action from occurring?
Mr. Van Offlin.
Mr. Chair, Senator, on the bigger scale, no, that's not my expertise. Tracking the invasives through ballast water, I think it's clear that there isn't a strong will to get any action done because it potentially would cost some money for the transportation industry. So,
Senator Stump, and then we have to move to the next witness.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Van Offlin, is what effort is being done by, and I don't know if this is the correct term, but the Great Lakes Compact, and I think all of the states around the Great Lakes are in that compact, and I mean, their whole mission is really to take care of the health of the Great Lakes. Is this something that they've I don't think the legislation that we have before us is actually part of a, it doesn't look like it's part of a compact.
Senator Rest.
Great Lakes Compact deals only with water diversions inside and outside of the basin. That is water water appropriations, water removal from the Great Lakes. And it came about, the compact came about among the Great Lakes states, signed by the governors, but only ratified now by two state legislatures, Minnesota and Illinois, but only has to do with taking water out of the Great Lakes, which is not permitted under the compact. Once everybody signs it, the other six Great Lakes have to sign it. We already know that we have the cooperation of Ontario and Quebec in this regard, and once all the Great Lakes states have signed it or ratified it, then it needs to be consented to by an action of Congress in order to be effective. We passed it easily in Minnesota because our permitting standards already are, quite frankly, stronger than what the compact itself called for. There would be very little legislative action called for once the compact is put in place. And actually, Minnesota's water permitting laws and regulations are looked to as a model by other Great Lakes states, but some of them don't have any. And so it's taking them a while to come up with accompanying legislation to ratifying the compact. But this doesn't have to deal, as you point out, this does not, this bill deals with ballast water exchange and not with removing fresh water from the Great Lakes and sending it to our friends in Atlanta. That, under the compact, would not be allowed.
Compact is about quantity of water. This is about quality.
Correct.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rest, the reason I bring that up is that, you know, several chapters several places in your legislation you talk about in the waters of the state, and I can, you know, if you look up in the Duluth Harbor, there's a line that kind of goes right down the harbor between Wisconsin and Minnesota, and so, you know, I can see these ships diverting maybe, and I'm not sure how exactly, I haven't had time to read this closely, but I can see the ships diverting a few hundred yards and then discharging and not having a penalty, basically. And I think the purpose of the compact, you know, I wish
compact
it was.
Compact doesn't address
that. I know,
it
doesn't address it, but but this only addresses if they dump the water 100 yards away from the Minnesota line, mm-hmm. or 200 yards or whatever, it won't achieve the same goal either.
But I can tell you also, Mr. Chairman and Senator Stuff, that Governor Doyle of Wisconsin is also very concerned about the impact of ballast water. What they look to is, of course, Lake Michigan with regard to the where most of their shoreline is impacted in the Great Lakes basin.
But they would not, under your bill, a ship would not be able to. I imagine my presumption is that a boat goes to Wisconsin or Minnesota side for a specific purpose. One to Minnesota to get into Minnesota's transportation system, and Wisconsin's superiors to get into the Wisconsin system. So if a boat is intending, it has product.
They go through that area, then they would have to have a permit no matter where they offload it.
If you have a boat intended for the Minnesota side of the port or with Minnesota products or products that are going through the Minnesota transportation system, then it would have to go to the Minnesota port, and as such exchange it 50 miles away or treat
wherever.
It
wherever.
So, yes, if Wisconsin does nothing, the ships intended for the Wisconsin port in Superior, that could affect us. But they would not be able to, if they were coming to Duluth, they would not be able to dump out of, under this rule, under this law, dump out on the Wisconsin side and then come over. Once you touch the Duluth Port Authority, these rules are all invoked. Yeah, it's still a problem if they're going to the Superior side and they're dumping on that side. Yes. But if there is any connection to the Duluth part, to the Duluth side, this law would be invoked. Rob Jost. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. excuse me. My name is Rob Jost. I'm the president of the Minnesota Fish and Bait Farmers Association. And just wanted to express our concern about the ballast water as well. We're glad it's not in Lake Superior yet. We're afraid it might be. We are testing our products already for VHS to be able to ship out of state to other parts of the country. But we must keep in mind also, once it gets to Lake Superior, does it stop there? Is Lake Mille Lacs next? What do you think the impact would be, the economic impact would be if it decimated our inland waters as well? I just want to say that we need to act on it now, and hopefully we can keep it out of Lake Superior as long as we possibly can.
Questions for the witness? Gary Botzik.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Gary Botzik, Executive Director for the Minnesota Conservation Federation, and also a lobbyist for Audubon, Minnesota. And I just wanted to bring just a couple short things to your attention. In our MEP briefing book, which you all have multiple copies, hopefully, in your office, there is an issue paper that I wrote on this very issue. And we get the organizations, and there's somewhere between 80 and 100 environmental conservation organizations in Minnesota. About 30 of them signed up, by offering their name. So kind of a quick survey of how important this is to the environmental conservation community. And I think you heard a lot of background about why that's true today. I also had the opportunity to represent the Minnesota Lakes Association for many years, and Senator Olson's comments made me think back to that. And the gentleman just hit it on the head again. Today's problem in the Great Lakes is tomorrow's problem in our inland lakes, and we've seen that with zebra mussel getting into Mille Lacs Lake and into the Ramsey County St. Paul water system just discovered last year. So this is something we have to, it's kind of like terrorism. You fight it there or you fight it here, and we suggest you fight it there. These Great Lakes are a jewel, and Senator Rest, and in fact, it makes me think back a year ago this month, we were here testifying both for the compact, which you folks put Minnesota on the map by becoming the first state to ratify that compact. And as Senator Rest mentioned, Illinois has added their name, and hopefully New York will be the next. They're having great difficulties in Michigan and other states for many political reasons. But we need to get those 8 states to ratify, and that's just to deal with the quantity, as Senator Stump's question pointed out. Quantity is a whole other story. President Bush started a process in 2004. It's led to this Great Lakes Collaborative Implementation Act, which is multiple bills. There's a big fly-in occurring in Washington, D.C. next week to work on the multiple bills, including invasive species. About 185 different invasive species have come through the so-called Great Lakes Expressway using ballast water and other means, attaching themselves to the outside of the ships as zebra mussel. Doesn't need to get in the ballast water. It'll attach to the outside of the boat as it did. 185 of those have occurred since the Great Lakes, or since the St. Lawrence Seaway was opened up for this purpose. So we need to act now. I also testified last February in this committee to Senator Sieben, who was here earlier, on a resolution memorializing Congress to sort of get off the couch and or the back bench and do something, and we've talked about that again today. Yes, would we like the international community? Would we like Congress and the U.S. government to move faster and move forward? Yes, but again, it's not happening, and we need to send that message, continue to send that message, and thank people like Senator Representative Overstar and others that are working hard on this. But you can send a message by moving this type of states' rights or states' stepping forward type legislation, just like you did with the Compact, just like you did with energy legislation last year, and we'll be doing again this year. Clean cars is another example, which your committee is going to take up in a week or two. States have to step forward. It's a teeter-totter. Once so many states get that, and when we did this with, under the Willard-Munger years, and Senator Frederickson and others worked with that, once so many states get there, the federal government has to act. This is an issue that needs more states to jump on that boat or that ship and ride it to Washington and force the federal government to do something. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions from Mr. Botzek. Thank you. So far, I've got Paul Eager from the PCA. Are there others who would like to testify against the bill? One? Any others? Two? You're welcome to wait, or if you'd like to join him at the table, you can do that now as well. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Paul Eager. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And to my left is Jeff Stollenwerk. He's a supervisor in our Duluth office and is available to answer any questions that the committee may have. I just want to start out by saying that the PCA concurs with many of the issues raised today by Senator Ress and others about the need to take action relative to aquatic invasive species, and particularly on the ballast water vector as a pathway for introducing those into Lake Superior. We take the issue very seriously, and we're currently in the process of developing a permit that would be available by September 30th of 2008. And we appreciate Senator Ress mentioning the letter that went out from the agency last week announcing two public meetings that we'll be having in early March to begin the public input process associated with the development of that permit. And I'd like to just take a few minutes to provide some perspective on why you may hear a lot about September 30th of 2008. There were a lot of references made to the pending Oberstar bill in Congress and the need for new federal regulations. But what's also important to understand is that the Environmental Protection Agency was sued in, I believe it was 2003, in a court decision out of Federal District Court in California, ordered EPA to develop a permit by September 30th of this year. EPA is appealing that decision. I believe the oral arguments in that case were, in that appeal, were earlier this late summer, early fall time frame. But EPA is also moving ahead with the development of a permit by that date under the court decision. And so I guess I would use that as an example of another common theme that you heard from other testifiers today, which is this is a national issue. And not only is Minnesota facing the prospect of having a permit in place either at the state level, which we're currently developing in light of the federal decision, or also if EPA does develop a permit and have that out and is able to have that out for state review and state implementation by the September 30th timeline. So I just want to provide that perspective. There's pending federal legislation, but there's also an existing court order that EPA is currently complying with. Having said that, we have been simultaneously advocating for that federal approach to be implemented, as you've heard from Senator Ress and others. It is the most effective and efficient means of ensuring that not only Lake Superior but all the Great Lakes are protected from future introductions of aquatic invasives. But we're also proceeding on a path to develop a state regulatory approach, and that was the subject of the letter that I believe the committee now has in front of you. Just a couple of reasons why September 30th, we believe, is a reasonable time frame. First and foremost, it allows the agency to continue the work that we've begun on reviewing and assessing the effectiveness of various performance standards and treatment technologies, which is part of our administrative process that we use in going through any kind of a rulemaking or the development of a permit to regulate various sources of discharges through our authorities in Chapter 115. But it also does allow the Environmental Protection Agency an opportunity to continue work on the permit as they've indicated that they are doing. And for us to be able to take an opportunity to review that work in September and determine if it fits Minnesota's needs, and hopefully it does, and we'll be able to implement an approach consistent with the other states. And if EPA's approach is not environmentally protective, we'll be in a good position to implement a state permit at that time. So I just wanted to provide you a little bit of context for what's happening at the federal level. I also want to thank Senator Ress for the author's amendment in response to the comments that we provided. It does address many of the issues that we've identified along with our partners at DNR, and we look forward to continuing to work with her in the future on some of the other outstanding issues. With that, with that author's amendment, it did significantly shorten my comments, but I'd just like to touch on a few of the issues that perhaps were not addressed in the amendment. And just moving forward, a couple of the general comments before I get into some of the specific subdivisions and sections of the bill. Senator Rest mentioned that we did raise a concern about responsibilities in the bill that are traditionally the responsibility of the Department of Natural Resources versus the Pollution Control Agency. And Chapter 84D, as Mr. Knopf and Senate Counsel could attest, is a statute that the Department of Natural Resources is charged with enforcing. And we'd like to continue to have a dialogue about what responsibilities are appropriate to the Pollution Control Agency and which responsibilities are appropriate to the Department of Natural Resources. Both agencies do have an important role in this area, and we certainly think that it's critical that we recognize the work the DNR has done and is doing in this area and continue to allow them the ability to do that work. One other general comment regarding some of the requirements in the bill. We're still in the process of evaluating as different reports and requirements of the agency to implement certain things as it's laid out in the bill. We want to make sure that we're able to do that in the time frames outlined, and so we'd want to continue to work with Senator Rest and the legislature to make sure that any expectations you have, we're able to fulfill those. And just a few notes on the items that are remaining from the issues we identified along with the Department of Natural Resources that were not addressed in the author's amendment. I would want to mention just Section 2, Subdivision 3, where the permit is required. I'd just like to tie this back to the work that the agency is currently undertaking to develop a state permit. Again, we're working under an understanding that not only Minnesota, but all the Great Lakes states will be subject to a national permitting scheme as of September 30th. So we're continuing to work along that pathway. And just to give you a sense of when we talk about we're developing a permit, that is something that we're going to do through a public process. I had a call from Senator Rest's office last Friday wondering if we had a regulation that we could provide to review. And we don't. That is actually something that we're going to be developing over the coming months, and we'll have out on public notice a draft regulation sometime later this spring, and then we'll receive public input and go from there in finalizing that for September 30th. Moving on to Section 3, this is an issue that was addressed in Senator Ress's amendment. We had raised a concern or a suggestion that it seemed like this was a provision meant to provide for either accidental or emergency releases of ballast water, and it seems that the amendment addressed that, but the language is a little bit awkward, and I don't know if it's something that needs to be refined a little bit more, but I think that was that issue was addressed in Senate Council. Mr. Knopf may have some additional suggestions at a later time for how that could be addressed. In Section 4, the ballast water exchange requirements section, Senator Rest noted that much of the bill was modeled after Congressman Oberstar's approach. And so there are some issues in the bill or some language in the bill that we're still trying to determine if we're able to adapt it to a Minnesota-specific scenario. And this seemed to be one of the sections that we want to sit down and review and make sure that it is applicable to Minnesota and to the Great Lakes system. Because, again, Congressman Oberstar's bill is addressing ocean-going vessels only. Senator Rest bill and actually the way the PCA is moving forward on development of a permit would be Lakers and the ocean-going vessels. So we just want to make sure that the language is consistent with the expectations. Moving ahead to Section 10, Senator Rest mentioned the Great Lakes panel on aquatic nuisance species. That was an issue that the Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Natural Resources identified. The DNR is the member of that panel for the state of Minnesota and is in the process of designating us, and we think that is appropriate and that we would hope to work with the author to ensure that DNR remains our primary representative on that group. In Section 11, the comments here are actually comments that DNR provided and that we incorporated into our joint comments that we developed for the author and for the committee. And again, this would be one of those areas that as we're looking at the proper coding of the bill between the Pollution Control Agency statutes, Chapter 115, and the Department of Natural Resources chapters 84D, and which responsibilities are assigned to which department. In particular, Section 11 and into Section 12, we're really recommending that those are appropriate to be in Section 84D, and the responsibility for these activities should reside in the Department of Natural Resources, and they have, again, current responsibilities for much of this work and have been and continue to address this in their current authorities and responsibilities. To that extent, there was in the author's amendment in Subdivision 2 in the state removal. This is an issue that the agencies jointly provided with a question about, not a question, we indicated that this really isn't a feasible activity to immediately kill, contain, and remove invasives in Lake Superior. And there was language added in the amendment to the extent practicable. And we'd, again, appreciate the opportunity to continue to work with the author to understand what the expectations would be, because even as it's written currently in talking with our partners at DNR, that's still language that causes some concern about what actually would be expected of the state in that subdivision. Moving ahead to the last section, I'd just like to discuss before making some final comments. The Section 12 emergency plan to prevent the introduction of viral hemorrhagic septicemia. Again, this is an area where the Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Natural Resources, we both have a role to play in this area. And the Department of Natural Resources, as referenced earlier by, I think, Mr. Van Offlin, does have a draft VHS plan, and I believe I don't know if you have in front of you the comments, the written comments that we provided, but I'll go through some of the issues that we identified with this Section 12. The DNR's plan addresses the non-ballast water vector, and that would be any item other than the ballast water discharges we've been discussing today. And the major elements of their plan include surveillance on the highest risk waters, including Lake Superior and the St. Louis River estuary, sampling of all wild broodstock source populations, used in DNR hatcheries, a VHS surveillance plan for DNR rearing ponds. They've also are either in the process of or plan to apply for Department of Agriculture, a USDA grant to assist with VHS surveillance. They've received about $100,000 to date. They're also proposing some regulation changes to address this issue. Should I continue, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, we have to start concluding here, too.
Just a couple more points I just wanted to bring to the committee's attention. On the ballast water vector side of the VHS issue, the PCA has been coordinating with the Coast Guard, U.S. and Canadian authorities, our sister states in the Great Lakes region, to develop, and the shipping industry as well, to develop a plan based on the latest VHS science, including risk factors associated with the spread of the disease. And our goal is to have a plan that could be implemented, Senator Ress mentioned, by the March 25th time frame, which is when we project the Sioux Locks would open. The amendment addressed that date, but we had a couple of questions regarding the rulemaking provision that was also tied in with that language. And as we're developing a permit for implementation on September 30th, at the same time we will be implementing entering into rulemaking to repeal an exemption that exists in Minnesota rules for vessels to obtain an NPDES permit from the state of Minnesota. It essentially mirrors the exemption that's been in place at the federal level since the passage of the Clean Water Act, the one that the Environmental Protection Agency was in litigation over. And so our intent is to repeal that rule effective at the same time we would have a permit available on September 30th. And the language as written, and perhaps the author or Senate counsel could clarify, it appears to indicate that the rule would be exempt from the rulemaking provisions in Minnesota statutes and that the repeal of that exemption would be effective immediately. And that would be of concern to us if we repeal the exemption before the state actually has a permit in place. And I would indicate to Senator Rest that we'd appreciate working with her to make sure that we're not having unintended consequences as a result of that provision. With that, Mr. Chair, I know you would like to move on. There are others that would testify,
Mr. Eager, when was the federal court decision made?
Mr. Chair, the federal court decision in California was issued in 2006.
So the MPCA believes that the federal court decision requires NPDES permits as of September 2008. That decision was in 2006?
Mr. Chairman, the decision was issued in 2006, and the court issued a decision that said the EPA exemption would be vacated as of September 30th of 2008. So they gave EPA 2 years to develop a regulation.
Mr. Chairman, if you'd like to review it, I do have a copy of the decision.
No, it was just the date that I was interested in because that was in 2006. Your letter of intent to create these regulations is last Friday, and I received a copy of it by email after 5 o'clock on Friday, and the person who sent it to me received it after 5 o'clock as well. So can you explain the delay between 2006 and 2008 in your mere intent to develop these regulations?
Mr. Chairman, the letter you're referencing announces the scheduling of public meetings associated with the development of the permit. We have actually been working on this issue for much longer than just last Friday, and Senator Ress's office was actually invited to a meeting that we had last November. Representative Hansen, who's the House author of this bill, was able to attend that meeting. Senator Ress had staff in attendance, which we very much appreciated. We have been coordinating with the other states, with the U.S. Coast Guard. Commissioner Moore's met with the Coast Guard commander out of Cleveland. And let me just for the committee's sake, the Coast Guard is actually the primary regulatory authority associated with the ballast water discharge. So I just want to clarify, Mr. Chair, that the letter on Friday was not announcing the beginning of the process. The letter on Friday was announcing that we have actual dates for public meetings to gather, to begin the process of gathering public input associated with the development of the permit.
Second paragraph, the MPCA is proceeding with the development of a regulatory program. Was that the first time that statement was made by the PCA?
No, Mr. Chair, that was not. In fact, I testified in November in front of Representative Wagenius's committee in the House Environment and Natural Resources Finance Committee about the work that we had been engaged in, and also our plans for the future in developing a state regulatory strategy at the same time that we were advocating for a federal approach. In addition, I was in front of the LCCMR last fall. You heard reference to the Great Ships Initiative supporting the application that they had submitted for some support from the state in that area. And actually, Mr. Chair, also thinking back, Commissioner Moore had an op-ed article in the Duluth News Tribune in early December where he discussed this issue and highlighted the need for federal response, but also the need for the state to also start taking necessary steps to implement regulatory approaches.
And the permit that you're seeking under the I believe the federal court decision requires permits as of September 30th, 2008. Which ships will those permits apply to? All ships or just ocean going?
Mr. Chairman, my understanding is that EPA's proceeding on the development of a permit that would apply to all vessels that discharge. So it would include both ocean going and the lakes only vessels.
So this permit that you're developing will apply to Lakers and Salties, to use the
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Vernacular. All right. Okay. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question, Deputy Commissioner. For point of information, Great Lakes Commission is meeting in Washington, D.C. coming up the latter part of this month. Do you go to that? Are you going to be attending that? I know ballast water is on the agenda there. I'm just wondering.
Mr. Inger. Mr. Chairman, Senator, no, I do not attend the Great Lakes Commission meetings. Perhaps the legislative members, I don't think so.
That's fine.
Yeah. It's certainly something I could check in with you on beforehand, and if it makes sense, Mr. Chairman, to have myself or a representative from our agency attend, we'd certainly be happy to work with you on that.
Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to make aware to the committee members that the Great Lakes Basin Compact does have the authority to look at the regulations and cooperative action to eradicate the destructive and parasitical forces endangering the fisheries, wildlife, and other water resources. So I think they have more than just the regulation of the water level.
Senator Rust?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Stumpf, under the compact itself, I mean, the states would still retain the action to do that. The compact itself does not set up standards or require permitting or anything like that is in this bill. But the compact language makes all kinds of statements about encouraging cooperation among the compact states for environmental as well as steps leading to greater economic prosperity of the Great Lakes, too. But the compact itself is directed toward water diversions and appropriations from the that is the heart of that matter of the compact.
Ms. Doyle, what was the question?
And not without controversy in other states, quite frankly, that
Ms.
don't
Doyle,
have
the,
permitting
question you had?
Regulations.
Mr. Chairman, my question just was, in the your summary with comments, it says the EPA is currently developing the permit program. Are you also developing a permit program, and who is actually the issuing body of the permits under this scheme?
Mr. Eager.
Mr. Chairman, EPA is currently developing a permit that would be presumably, again, we don't have many of the details on how this permit would work from EPA, but Minnesota, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, is the delegated authority for carrying out the permitting authorities under the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, the NPDS system. So presumably, even if it's an EPA permit, the Pollution Control Agency would be the responsible authority. And obviously, in the development of a, if it's a state permit that we end up developing and implementing in September, the Pollution Control Agency would be the issuing authority on that point.
Mr. Pagel and Mr. Wally, would you like to make extremely abridged comments now, or would you like to make more complete remarks at our next committee hearing? In either case, we'll be laying this bill over.
Mr. Chairman, very briefly, I'll make an abbreviated statement. Kevin Wally, and I'm speaking today on behalf of the Duluth Seaway Port Authority. I just wanted to let the committee know that Adolph Ojard, the executive director of the Port of Duluth, has been very active at the federal level in trying to seek federal action on this matter. In fact, in testimony before Congressman Oberstar's committee last March, he indicated that comprehensive federal ballast water program is needed to accomplish two important goals. One, to harness market forces to protect the environment, and two, to create an orderly regulatory environment within which commerce can flow unimpeded. And I think, just in a nutshell, it's the concern about a patchwork of permitting standards that shippers might find themselves needing to comply with that's driving the ports in the Great Lakes to go to Congress and urge them to come up with something that's more broad-based and comprehensive. Now, having said that, Mr. Ojard did indicate in his own testimony on Monday in the House committee a willingness to work with the authors on what is going forward here in the state legislature. But I just wanted to put it in the context of his concern about having some inconsistency, perhaps, from one state to another, one province, as opposed to the individual state standards.
Is it true that both versions of the federal House and Senate bills only apply to ocean-going vessels?
That is correct at this time, yes.
You agree that that's only 10% of the traffic?
Yeah, the traffic coming to Duluth, I think it's slightly above 10%, 11 or 13%.
Thank you. Mr. Pagel, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair.
And again, you are welcome to make more complete remarks at the next hearing, if you prefer.
Yeah, I appreciate that, and I'd want someone to be here as well. My name is Craig Pagel. I'm with the Iron Mining Association of Minnesota. I represent about half of the cargo that goes through the Duluth port. The other half would be grains and a few other type of shipments, which I'll talk about just very briefly. My request is that you take a real hard look at this, because the economic impact it could have if it's not done right. If there's not the ability to ship out of Duluth Harbor and we start moving it to just other ports, as an example, the chair brought up Superior, the Alawese docks. They could just come in the Superior side. There's another entrance to the harbor that it's not under the nice lift bridge that we have in Duluth. They literally could just come in there under different rules. And it could really change how things happen, and you would not solve the problem that's coming up. I'm probably the only one in the room that lives in Duluth. I look at Duluth every morning when I get up if I'm not living down here. I don't want to ruin that lake any more than anyone else. We need to do this in a very well thought out process. To give you a quick idea, there's over $110 million worth of economic impact because of the Duluth Harbor. That's over 2,000 jobs directly. That doesn't include the other jobs, not only in the mines, but the farmers that ship through there. About half the cargo is that. So it's a little more complex than we might look at the onset, and I'd want to work through it. I'm always willing to work with any authors on this. The last thing to think about, too, is we talk about ships, when they come into a port, they need to know what they're coming into so that all of a sudden they're not held off, not able to come into the port. As an example, there were, let's see if I can find the numbers real quick here, there were 158 ocean-going ships this year. That was up 22 ships. 17 of those ships were bringing renewable generation windmills in. And it was amazing to watch them go through the city of Duluth. There were five that went out carrying blades all over the world that were manufactured just across the border in North Dakota that were shipped through Minnesota to be shipped out there to go around the world. So it isn't just one thing to think about here. Believe me, I love to fish in the estuary of the St. Louis area, but I also know that we have to take care of jobs and the impact that it might have.
Are there two different port authorities, one Duluth, one Superior?
There's one port authority, if I'm not mistaken. Kevin, you represent them, so maybe you should. Okay. There is one port authority, but there are two port entrances. One is in Superior, and one is under the lift bridge in Duluth. So one's in Wisconsin, one is in Minnesota, and it's got a really interesting history. The natural one is on the Wisconsin side. The Duluthians started digging. There was a court order to stop it back at the turn of the century, but luckily they dug enough through in the middle of the night that the water itself pushed through. Then they put the aerial lift bridge over it over time.
So the Duluth Port Authority includes Superior, Wisconsin? Is that correct?
Yes. They work with both. Go ahead.
Mr. Wally?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, the individual facilities, the grain elevators and the ore docks are not under the jurisdiction of the Duluth Seaway Port Authority, though those are, you know, privately owned and operated facilities. So your iron ore going out of Duluth or Superior is not specifically under the jurisdiction of the Duluth Seaway Port Authority. Similarly, there are grain elevators on both sides of the harbor. And then there's a coal dock on the Superior side, and there's not a coal dock on the Duluth side. So there are some interstate issues that I think we should think about and talk through.
We'll have to delve into that particular issue more. Senate file 2517 is laid over for further consideration.
Thank you, Chair.
Meeting's adjourned.
Chairman. Thanks. Oh.